History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we've learned over the years that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then be patient enough to listen as stories from long, long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. The man we have the privilege of meeting today has had more than a few adventures in his 92 years. 70 years ago, he was a medic in the Korean War. We caught up with him in Reedley, California, but we're going to let him introduce himself in the language he spoke extensively for 20 years as a missionary, Japanese.
私は Ivan D. Borugemus と申します。こちらは私の息子、テリーさんです。I introduced myself as Ivan D. Wolgamuth, and this is my son, Terry Wolgamuth.
So you probably did that a few times in 20 years on the mission field, huh?
Oh, yeah. 家内と私は娘もありいました。娘の名前はサンドラ・ジーン・ボルゲムスです。And I just said that we have a daughter by the name of Sandra, and her name is Sandra Borugemus. That's Wolgamuth.
It rolls off your tongue, but I'm sure it wouldn't have back in Hooker, Oklahoma, where you were born in 1931, and you're a child of the Dust Bowl. That's how your family ended up here in California. But I'm wondering what kind of early family memories you have from the 1930s.
I remember the dust storms we had in Oklahoma, and then I remember when our family decided to move to California like a bunch of Okies did at that time, and we had a 31 Chevy sedan pulling a four-wheel grain trailer with all our belongings in it. When we got to California, they asked if we had anything else yet, and my folks said no. And then they went to Shafter, California. They had friends there, and my folks picked up potatoes in Shafter to make a little money so we could go on to Orland, to where we lived there. And finally, we were able to buy a 10-acre place there close to the Sacramento River, and that was good. I went to an elementary school called McIntosh all 8 years, and sometimes we would go barefooted when we could, and finally my folks bought my brother and I a bicycle, and we would take turns pumping each other to school, and then our arrangements on Sunday was that one Sunday he would have the bike and the next Sunday I would have the bike. But we always went to church in the morning at Wednesday night prayer meeting, and in the evening we had church. Usually missionaries would come and give their reports there. So it was a good life. We did a lot of fishing and everything went well.
Do you remember at a young age having some thought in your head of, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I want to do with my life?
I don't know if I did at that time, but I always admired the missionaries. They would come and give reports from India, from Africa, and other places of the world, and China. And I thought, how wonderful that is to bring the gospel to other people.
I guess I should also ask, too, since it was the Dust Bowl and, you know, the greater theme of the Great Depression that brought your family from Oklahoma out here to California. Do you have some memories of those Depression years that maybe kids today would be alarmed by or have it raise their eyebrows a little bit?
Well, when we came through New Mexico and Arizona, I remember the Indians trying to hold up different wares. They wanted us to buy them, and the hobos would ride on the trains, on top of the trains, and in the boxcars. There was a lot of that. going back and forth.
Yeah, not something we'd be used to today for sure. And, you know, what about also, I guess you're 10 years old when America is drawn into World War II. And a lot of the folks I speak with on this program were in World War II. You were too young for it. But I'm sure you have some memories of those war years and how things changed.
I remember we heard that Pearl Harbor was bombed, and so we intently listened to the radio. We had an old Philco radio that we could listen to, and then it wasn't long our area decided that they would have a plane watch, and I volunteered with my dad, did too, and my brother. And we would go to a certain place, and for 4 hours, we would listen for planes to come. Any plane that we heard, we could almost identify it, and then we'd call in and say, it's such and such a plane going somewhere. We were kind of fearful that the Japanese were coming into California, too.
And I'm sure at the time, you couldn't have imagined spending 20 years in Japan.
I guess that all started when I was 17, and I volunteered to take those goats, 250 goats with three other men, that we took care of the goats on a ship.
And I've got to stop you there for a second, because some people are saying, what in the world are you talking about? 17-year-olds volunteering to take 250 goats. How does that happen? What was the story here? How did you get roped into that?
Well, Sunday evening, we had a young people's meeting in the Dinuba MB Church, and we had a person come in there, and he told us about this goat program. And that evening, he said he was going to, we had a local small Japanese church, and he'd be there. Two other fellows, myself, went over there and volunteered, but the other two backed out, but I was determined. I wanted to go, and my folks were a little bit concerned with it, but in a way, we went to Modesto, where they gathered all the goats together, and then from there, we took them to San Francisco and loaded them on the ship. So that was quite a trip, too. That was my first introduction to Japan.
Yeah, and I would imagine just the journey over there had to be something, especially with all those goats.
Yeah, I know. Our job was to feed the goats and to water them, to clean the pens. And then when we got to Yokohama, well, they unloaded them, and they were used for milk and for hospitals and orphanages. And during that time is when I learned to know of this. One of our persons was Sim Togasaki, and he could speak Japanese well, and his parents were elderly Togasakis, had moved to San Francisco about just before the earthquake in 1903. We remained friends, too, for all these years with the Togasaki family.
And I suppose I should ask you that, too, because I know you moved from up north in Orland down to this Dinuba Reedley area and went to Emmanuel High School, and that was at the end of World War II and the years that followed. But this area during World War II, all the Japanese American families were forced out, sent to camps. When you came to this area, did you get a taste of what had happened? Did you have friends who were Japanese American? Did you have any inclination of any of that?
Yes, we had neighbors, Kay and Rosie Watanabe in Dinuba, and they had been to, they were taken to these camps. It was not an easy life, and we became close friends, so they would come to our place, and in a way we would eat together and so on. But I know of another Japanese family that were taken into the camp. Their name was Abe, and there was a Virgil Kleinsasser said that he would go and take care of their ranch for them. And I think he did it for nothing, you know, just wanted to develop friendship. So there was almost all the Japanese were taken into camps.
Yeah, and there was a tenor during that time of anti-Japanese fervor here in the States. Obviously, that's what led to that. And even after the war, I mean, I've met some veterans who they say it took them decades to even consider buying a Japanese car or anything like that. There was this hostility between America and Japan. And I ask that because you're going to Japan about 3 years after the surrender as an American teenager with 250 goats.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes and understand the perspective that you had.
I never did have an animosity against the Japanese. I felt more I wanted to help them. And that's why I volunteered to take those goats over there, because I knew that the goats would provide milk for the hospitals and orphanages over there. And they did this in Okinawa, too. Europe, they did cattle over there after the war.
And was there something that happened on that trip for you that kind of put a thought in your mind or lit a flame in you for Japan?
I don't know at that time. Maybe not. It was later on when I was in the Army in Korea, and I went on R&R to Japan twice. And at that time, I went once to Osaka area and stayed with the Sam Krauses, who were missionaries in Japan. He had also been in the Army and was on the island of Okinawa. Later on became a missionary, but at that time I got my first idea of mission work in Japan. Sam Krause took me to the camp area, what they had there, and the churches, and I don't know, I just felt maybe someday I would go there too.
Well, and you brought up the Army, and I want to hear about that. How did you end up in the Army as a medic during the Korean War?
I was in the Army for 2 years, but I got to Korea on New Year's Day, 1953. I landed at Busan, and we got off the ship. And when we got off the ship, they gave us what we called Mickey Mouse boots, thermal boots, and a big heavy overcoat, and then K rations. And we got on a rickety old Korean train and went north. We ended up at Yeongdong-po, and there they assigned us to our different units. Then I was assigned to this 123rd Medical Psychiatric Unit in a holding company. We were there for some time, and then we moved out, went to another camp a little closer towards the front lines. My buddy Irvin Taves was also from our church, and he went to Incheon to the Air Force Base there, and he was a baker. But on Sundays, he and I would try to meet with each other at the 51st Evac Hospital. Finally, I got enough other guys to go there, so they would furnish us what they called a weapons carrier, like a truck. So we'd try to meet there as often we could. They had a good chaplain there. We also had, once in a while, a chaplain would come to our unit, and we'd just have church in a tent, and these army benches that are just canvas and fold open. And the time I was in at night, I spent 14 months on cots, you know, just regular old cots with a mattress. And later on, I got a sleeping bag. It was so cold in winter. Our river close by, the Incheon River, would freeze over a meter thick. And then summer, it got so hot and humid, and we had to watch out for mosquitoes. And there were other buddies that I knew, too, had ended up over there. Just before I guess it was in 1953, about April, they had a wounded prisoner exchange up by Panmunjom. Of course, it was out in the rice fields. The army engineers had put down a metal bat so the helicopters could land, and ambulances come up and exchange prisoners, wounded prisoners. That was interesting to me. Later on, when we were missionaries in Japan, all of a sudden I got a letter saying that the Korean government was willing to give any veteran 1 week of hotels, food, and sightseeing if we could get over there. So I told my wife, we were in Japan already, let's just go. Didn't take long, and we landed there at Incheon Airport, and that's, we spent a week and were able to go up north to the place where we had been. And then we went up to the 38th parallel, where they've had those meetings with the North and the South. And our leader told us, now, you can walk around the table, don't make any gestures, but that way you'll have been in North Korea. And so That's what I can say today. I'm still to this day very happy that I could be in the service. I think about it almost every day. Not always easy, but it was rewarding.
Well, I've got a lot of questions about it. But the first one, an important one, did they draft you or did you volunteer to go in?
I was drafted. 1 year after we were married on February the 9th, 1951, and 1952 is when I was drafted. If you want me to, I can read a verse in Deuteronomy 24:5 where it says, a man should not go out to fight until a year after you're married. And so I don't know if the draft board do that verse or not, but anyway.
You mean you didn't send that verse to Uncle Sam?
No, I have it here, though.
Well, and there's a reason for that, right? That newlyweds should spend some time together. So how did your wife feel about that?
She moved in with her parents. And then when I was in Korea on August 31st, she gave birth to a daughter, Sandra. And I got a telegram in Korea that she had been born. We got together and had some refreshments with some of the other guys there and celebrated a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I've interviewed a fair share of veterans who didn't get to meet their firstborn child till they came home from war. And I've always tried to put myself in their shoes and there seems to be a couple sides of it. It seems a little bittersweet, right? I mean, you'd really like to be there, and isn't there an element, too, of, well, I better make it home now?
Yeah, and after I finally got home, I went to, we landed at Camp Stoneman here in California, and then we were, when I was out, I was looking for my folks and folks-in-law, and finally they saw me, and my wife came out with our daughter, Sandra, and I was so happy to see them both, you know, and so then from there we came back to Dinuba then.
Sure, everybody can feel what you're feeling as they listen to you. With regard to your time in the Army, though, so they draft you, they take you overseas away from your pregnant wife. What were your expectations of what you were going to do over there?
Well, I really didn't know, but I had gone to, I took my basic training at Camp Pickett in Blackstone, Virginia, and then I went to San Antonio, Texas, where they have their medical school. I signed up for x-ray technician, but the school was full, so they put me into this neuropsychiatric unit. And I had some other buddies there too, so we took training there, and then we did practical work in El Paso, Texas, at Beaumont General Hospital. Then from there I went home and for furlough for about a week, and then I flew to Seattle, Washington, where there was a little camp there, I guess you'd call it a repo depot, where the soldiers all came together, and finally they called our names, and 3,000 of us went and boarded a ship. The Marine Serpent was the name of the ship. As we got on board with a duffel bag and our handbag, the Gideons were there to give us each a testament. And we went on board and found our place. I was towards the end, since Wolgamuth with W, and it was towards the bow of the ship, which was a good thing. And we had hammocks about four or five high, and I took the second or third one. And they had already chosen all the guys to do the KP, and so I did have to do that. But then we went out on board again, out to the outside, and the Army chaplain prayed, and then the Army chorus sang, God be with you till we meet again. And I know that 3,000 of us went over there, but I don't know if how many came back, and I know some were killed there in the war, but I thank the Lord that I could come back.
Well, and that was a question I was going to ask you, especially in light of having to leave behind your new wife and then knowing that you were expecting a child. Was there any question in your mind? Did you ponder that thought maybe I'm not going to make it back to see this wife. Maybe I'll never meet this child that I don't know who that's going
to
be.
Yeah, you have to think that way because you never know. In our company, we had what we called 10 o'clock bed check Charlies come over, little Piper Cub type of planes, and they'd throw out incendiary bombs. And sometimes they would hit a oil dump and blow up everything. But we would run out to foxholes to take cover. And one time they dropped a bunch of propaganda sheets. And I still have some of those things. And I've kept most of my Army stuff. And in a way, I thank the Lord that I could go. And when I was drafted, I was drafted with another fellow, a friend, Delbert Reimer. And we were just one number apart. My number was US 56127753. And I forget whether his was one number more or one number less. But in a way, we were inducted finally at Fresno first and went to Fort Ord, which I don't think is there anymore. But there we got outfitted. And then from there, we got on a train and started heading for Virginia. And on our way at Wells, Nevada, our train got snowed in for 4 days. And we had sleeper cars, good facilities, and the food. And we could walk around outside until we had to leave again. And then we went on to Chicago and changed trains and went down to Virginia. And that's kind of that story.
I guess I should ask you, too. I don't know the answer to this. There are different denominations and faiths that in the war preferred to be conscientious objectors and not be part of the fighting. Was that the case with the Mennonite brethren that your family was a part of?
Yeah, there were some that went into doing hospital work and so on and so forth. But I went and talked to our pastor at that time, B.J. Brown, and he said he thought he would go into the Army. I was a 1AO, so I didn't have to carry a weapon, but I took the training along with everybody else.
So you didn't have to carry a weapon because of the pacifist nature of the Mennonite religion?
Yes, that's the way it was, but I did all the training that the other soldiers did, like, we had to all get into a trench and then go under barbed wire while they were shooting live ammunition, tracer bullets, you crawl out and you turn on your back and you wiggle under the barbed wire, keep your head down, and I did all of that. I went on all the marches. We did our compass work at night, and it was just part of everything except carrying weapons.
And how did you feel about that?
I think I felt okay. Sometimes I would feel sorry for guys carrying their weapons on marches. I'd carry it for them. And in Korea we had steel helmets, and we had those. We could turn them upside down, and they had a place to put into a wooden thing that was our wash basin and wash up there, and I was happy with that.
It's time for our first break, but there's more to come with 92-year-old Korean War veteran Ivan Wolgamuth of Reedley, California. More from his time in Korea as a medic in a neuropsychiatric unit, and also how his family ended up becoming missionaries to Japan. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 92-year-old Ivan Wolgamuth of Reedley, California. Born in Oklahoma, he came to California in the wake of the Dust Bowl. His Mennonite faith made him a conscientious objector in the Korean War, so he did not carry a weapon. Unless, of course, he was given one of his buddies a break, as we heard. As a medic with the 212th Neuropsychiatric Unit of the 123rd Medical Holding Company, he not only dealt with all the weather conditions Korea was famous for, but also some extreme cases of soldiers dealing with what we recognize now as PTSD.
And as far as your day-to-day in Korea, I know you've got some great pictures of it, and you talked about some of the conditions you had to deal with, the bitter cold in the winter and the hot humidity in the summer. But on a day-to-day basis, what kinds of things were you guys doing?
Well, first we had the open wards when they would bring guys in. We called them choppers, not helicopters, and go out there and run out and get them their stretchers. They were on the outside. They could carry one on each side of the choppers and bring them in, and they were evaluated by the doctors, and some they thought just should be in an open ward. In other words, food and exercise and medical help would help them. And then we had a closed ward, which was a Quonset metal building. And for a while, I was in charge of that, and we had to watch them, those people, day and night. I remember one person was in there. He was a black man, strong as all get out, and they had him tied to the bed. He could just make it rock. And he says, if you ever are given some dope, don't take it, but just kill him. He's not worth anything to you. In fact, he said he would kill me if he could, but he was tied down. Well, afterwards, he got better, and he was taken loose, and he said, you know, Ivan, he says, I love you. You're a good man. And we had those kind of people, too. We had to be very careful that if they could get a mirror or anything, they could cut their wrists. So in a way, that was a kind of a good experience to see that part of life, too.
Yeah, but challenging, I'm sure. And you mentioned it earlier that you were part of a neuropsychiatric unit, so I'm sure people imagine some of the stuff you're dealing with. But you're seeing guys who really could be you, right? Similar age to you and in the same army, who whatever they've been through has altered their awareness and consciousness to the point that they needed you guys. How much did that weigh on you, just seeing human beings in that kind of predicament?
Well, we were just there to try to help, and I know some of the doctors felt that I had training in this electroshock treatment. And the doctor would give the electric shock, but we had to hold their hip and not, because they would jerk so hard, they didn't want them to break a hip or their leg, and so I'd see that. And then we had insulin shock therapy. They give a person enough insulin that they go into shock, and then they give them glucose to bring them out again. Those you have to really be careful to watch it, and just at the right time they need that glucose to bring them out. I think back of my time in the Army, and I'm very happy and proud that I could be there.
What would you say was the most challenging aspect of your 2 years in the Army?
Some of the most fearful times were we had these potbelly heaters with a tin chimney going up through the roof, and we would use those potbelly heaters to get warm. We'd put our arms around, kind of, and then the chimney, we could take our caps and iron them that way, just put them on the But when the wind came, I was always afraid that they would burn up. You know, they would break apart the chimney, the parts, but never did happen. And I know other tents burned down, but in a way, I don't think I, other than that, had any real fearful moments.
Well, you told us about, you know, bed check Charlie throwing stuff out at you, too. You mentioned trying to stay warm. Do you remember the coldest temperature you endured over there?
I don't know, but I know that the Han River froze a meter thick. You could drive on it with a truck, and the Koreans would cut it with big saws and put the ice in the caves, and that would be in the summertime their ice water or whatever they used it for.
And did you get to interact at all with the Korean people?
Yeah, we had a houseboy. He would help us in whatever we wanted them to do, and we got to know them quite well. We paid them. We'd always give them a gift, you know, at different times of the year, and bring them food, because there were always Koreans where the soldiers couldn't eat all the food, and they'd dump it instead of into the garbage that Korean people would want to have it. But these houseboys we treated really nicely, and actually everybody contributed some money every week or month, and that was quite a bit of money for them.
And how often did you hear from your wife while you were over there?
I think I had a letter almost every day. See, it didn't cost anything to send the airmail letters. We had an APO number. And later on, when we were missionaries, her mother, Mrs. Zimmerman, she would send a letter almost every day, too. So that was we always kept up with news from back home.
You know where she got it from. I guess I should have asked you that, too. Do you want to tell me the story of how you met your wife?
Two ways. We went to Emmanuel together. My third year, I had my eye on her. And then my dad and her dad and two other men had a quartet. And she would play the piano for them. And so I would go along just to be there and stay closer to her. And then during those years, we had Youth for Christ rallies every Saturday night in Dinuba High School Auditorium. And that was almost a must that I would go pick her up and take her to the Youth for Christ. Then after that, we'd go to A&W Root Beer and have a float there, yeah.
Great memories, and 71 years worth of memories with her, including all that time overseas that I want to hear about. Is there anything else about your time in the Army in Korea that you think is important for us to know? One thing that I think of is, you know, how often we've heard the Korean War referred to as the Forgotten War, but you haven't forgotten, and maybe you can share a reason why you think the rest of us shouldn't forget either. Why does it matter?
You know, as you know very well, Korea still isn't united, North and South. That concerns me. I look at all the progress that South Korea has made. When I got there, the city of Seoul was just in rubble. Going back later, it's become a big city, beautiful city. There is a church called the Yongnak Church right in the center of Seoul. The minister is Dr. Han. So we went to hear his messages and one Sunday, and later on in Japan, there was a Keswick conference in a city close by where we lived. Dr. Han was the speaker. He spoke English, Japanese, and Korean. Of course, he spoke in Japanese at that conference, and it was a large auditorium all on tatami mats. And we each had a zabaton, that's a little square, that was our place. There were two other missionaries and myself that went. One was Ben Zerbe. He's another fellow missionary in Japan. And in a way, he spoke on the Beatitudes. He talked about, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And he says, you know, he says, we Koreans have gone through a lot of persecution, but he says, we also have a lot of Christians because of that. And I thought of that quite often. My wife and I had been in his church in Seoul, Korea. there. The benches were not very nice benches, but very close together. And a whole group of people would come in and listen to his message. And then they'd file out in another door. And then a whole other group would come in. Three groups like that. So those kind of things impressed me a whole lot, you know. I think today, the largest church in the world is in Korea.
Well, and as I listen to that, I guess maybe what's coming to mind, there's a contrast there. So South Korea has flourished, but North Korea is a very different picture. And I've had a lot of Korean War veterans point out to me, hey, have you ever looked at a satellite photo of the Korean Peninsula at night and seen all the lights in the south and the pitch black in the north? Does that give you some satisfaction that you were part of keeping South Korea free?
Yes, I think so. But, you know, Billy Graham's wife, she was born in North Korea. I think in Panmunjom. Bell was her maiden name. Her folks were missionaries in China and then gone to Korea. I know North Korea has Christian people too, but they don't have the freedom that the South has.
Well, let's talk some more about your journey. So you get done serving in the Army, you come back here to California, you got a degree from Fresno State, you went to seminary at Fresno Pacific. How did it come about that you and your wife became missionaries to Japan and made that such a huge part of your life's work?
We farmed quite a bit together with my dad-in-law. We bought 160 acres and we raised a lot of cotton and had a lot of pasture land that we leased out to friends of ours, the Weist family, and they had cattle. But anyway, I picked cotton for a number of years. My dad-in-law bought a new cotton picker machine. But, you know, finally we thought maybe there's more in life to this than just farming. And so we decided that we felt the Lord was leading us into missions. So we sold the farm and moved to Fresno, right across the street from Fresno Pacific College at that time. I got a Calvet loaned. I only paid $100 down for that house, maybe $100 a month payment. Our kids went to Lane School. I went to Fresno State and to seminary at the same time and worked odd jobs. The first job was I helped one of these big cleaners that does sheets and everything. They have machinery on Saturday. They had to be cleaned underneath there. I'd crawl on my back, and I met another guy there, and turned out he was a Christian. And then I worked for General Box, making boxes for fruit, and that was at night from 5 o'clock till 11 or something like that. But that was a hard job because at 1 minute before we would go on time, we had to stand next to the other guy and another bell would ring and then it was our turn. The machine would never stop and you just keep going. And at the same time, we went to the West Park Church, west of Fresno. One of our seminary professors, Dr. Lange, went there too, and we had a pastor there, Jake Isaac, and he was a real good pastor for those people out there. And that's where we kind of learned to do mission work. And that's where my wife had a Sunday school for little girls, and our daughter was also in there, and she became saved at that time over there. So it one thing led to another, and those days we did have scholarships to go to seminary and live and everything, so I had to work to keep going that way. But Fresno State, at that time, the Shaw Avenue was just a two-lane road there and empty fields, on at least on the south side, and you could park anywhere there. And I enjoyed Fresno State. I had gone to Reedley College first and then went there and graduated, got my teaching credentials that helped me later on. So in a way, we had a lot of church experience through that West Park Church. One thing led to another, and finally we were on our way. We went to San Francisco, and about 100 people from our church and others came to the ship to see us off. And surprisingly enough, the ship didn't care if the people all came aboard. And They enjoyed that. The kids could run around and people, and it was an old immigrant ship that took Japanese to Brazil at one time, and so the accommodations weren't very good. We had just a little room with four bunk beds and just a wash basin, and then the restrooms were down the aisle, and most of them were Japanese restrooms. I think only one or two Western toilets, and the food wasn't that great either, but the Brazil Maru, the picture of it is on that book there. Mr. Fred Wiest, a man from Dinuba Church at that time, he gave a little send-off message and prayed, and everybody got off, and the ship pulled out, went underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, and you know, everything is exciting to that point. But when you get out a little ways, the waves come, and then you wonder, did we do the right thing, you know? But I praise the Lord that we did, you know. We got situated in Japan, lived in a very small house to begin with called, it was in Mondo Yakujin. From there, we went to, the kids could go to Canadian Academy, which is an international school. They had to get on a train there at Mondo Yakujin, go one station. It was almost at the end of the line, and the train was already full of people, and they'd have pushers to push the people in, and even Terry would crawl in between their legs and he'd get in there. They go to this Nishinomiya station, then transfer to another train to go to Roko, is where the school is, only it's on a hill way up high. And from there, maybe a taxi, even people get together, and a very steep road up there. We were happy that they could come home at night. And at that time, there were some other missionary kids. They had a boarding house right there at Roko, and they would stay there. But we decided if they can make it home, it's better to be home. Our simple house was, let's see, there was a small living room, they go by tatami size, and then a bedroom, and then there was a Terry's room, was a very small wooden floor room, and then we had an upstairs, which is a little bigger tatami room, and that's where our daughter was. And the wash basin, our bath, ofuro, was inside in the kitchen there. And then we had a kitchen with about a 2-foot-high sink, and then one of these water, if you want hot water, you turn it on, it automatically gets hot, and that's the way we lived there. We had to get used to washing outside. We had gotten a Maytag washer for outside with a wringer and all that, and it was cold out there, later on, we moved to a newer house close to a place called Takarazuka, Mount Virginia, and that was up a high hill. So we either walked it or we did have a car then. We had a double assignment. One was working at our campgrounds. On the way, Terry's always looked at a motorcycle shop there, and he bought an old Suzuki motorcycle. He could barely get up that hill.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, what Ivan experienced on his honor flight to Washington, D.C. We'll also hear from his son, Terry, who followed in his father's missionary footsteps. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a fascinating visit with a veteran who by now you can tell is a man of faith. Over the years on Hometown Heroes, we've met veterans from many different faith backgrounds, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Buddhist. We've met veterans whose service in World War II bolstered their belief in God, and a few over the years who have told us that they could no longer believe in God the way they once did after what they witnessed in wartime. Korean War veteran Ivan Wolgamuth and his late wife Jean spent 20 of their 71 years of marriage as Mennonite Brethren missionaries to Japan, where the churches they started decades ago continue to grow.
Some of the hardships were medical facilities. Terry got the measles very badly, but we found a doctor right close to where we lived and were able to take care of him there. And Gene had to have a surgery, and it was at back of Colby there. Seventh-day Adventist had a hospital, and finally got her over there and took care of that. And then we went to a place called Karuizawa, where the evangelical missionaries would gather and have a conference there. And while there, our daughter felt a pain, and she had to have a appendectomy. And the local hospital there was full, and they said, well, we know of another doctor out in the country, and he knows a little English. So we followed the car and went over there, and it was called Iwamurada. The waiting room was just full of people, and we said that Gina has to have a surgery, and the surgeon said, well, I'll do it right now. And he just takes a wash basin and washes his hands like this, and she went and did a surgery, and it did turn out well, but nothing was very clean. People on the upstairs would throw their water out from the top and go down the screens. And when we went in there to see her, Sandy, she was laying on a tatami mat, and another missionary, Roland Weenses, they came to see her. And when he saw that whole thing, he says, let's pray. In a way, it turned out that she got well and very little scar and went back to living at where we lived at that time. And so through thick and thin, we have been able to take care of things, and the Lord has helped us. And Jean says that later on she looked in this Bible and she found the verse, I will heal you. And she said she doesn't know where it was written, but in a way, that was the promise that gave to Jean that our daughter would be healed. And even with that, the way it all turned out to be a good surgery.
Well, and speaking of the way it all turned out, I'm sure we could, you know, you've got 20 years worth of stories from back over there. But I'm just wondering, you said something that when you were leaving San Francisco, you got under the Golden Gate, and then all of a sudden it was, hey, are we doing the right thing? Did you ever have days in those 20 years in Japan where you said, hey, I don't know if we did the right thing, or I don't know if we're supposed to be here or not? Were there things that made you wonder if you were doing the right thing?
I don't think so. Once we got to Japan, learned to know the other missionaries, and we got into language school, we would every day learn something new and go shopping a little bit, try to use it and Japanese, and I don't think so. I look back, and in fact, for our kids, they have class reunions yet, so I don't regret that at all. It has given us a more of an insight to other countries and their way of life. And Gene and I have taken a cruise south of Japan. We stopped at Korea. We stopped at Okinawa, went all the way around Taiwan, and stopped at Hong Kong. And so it's been a wonderful life, and Terry and Shelley, they went to Indonesia, to Borneo. We visited them, I think it was twice. Saw that work over there and everything they were doing. And it was hot and sultry there, but all of a sudden we'd be eating and a breeze would come through the jungle. You could just hear it. And then it would cool off. And I remember the ants were so bad, they took little cans of oil or something to put on the table legs, you know, so they wouldn't come up to the table. And in a way, their work was very important, too.
Well, I'm wondering, too, you know, with all the time that you and your family spent in Japan, do you have a sense for the impact you had for the things that are there now that wouldn't be there, or the lives that were changed as a result of your willingness to do what you did?
I think I said before, we've gone back twice for dedication of churches. The churches have grown tremendously, and like they gotten wealth and put in elevators.
And these were churches you started?
Yes, Nagagawa Church and the Hiroshima Church. And we have people like Mr. and Mrs. Emoto were from the Hiroshima church. She became saved first. We were meeting in an upstairs room after we had met in our home. And then he brought her and said he thought that Christianity would be good for her because she was an outstanding lady in Hiroshima City, where they had women's meetings which would teach young ladies how to cook, flower arrangement, and tea ceremony, and all of that. But this Mr. Emoto, she brought other ladies to church, Mrs. Chikashige, and she was the first convert of her. And then there's another lady, Marita-san, and her husband was an engineer at Mazda car company in Hiroshima. And then this Mr. Emoto, he was quite a wealthy man, and he finally became saved 25 years later. When we went back for a dedication, they came and picked us up in the church van and took us to the best hotel in Hiroshima, Riga Hotel it was, and about the 10th, 13th story high, overlooking Hiroshima Castle, and cherry blossoms were blooming. It was just beautiful, and gave us meal tickets, so it didn't cost us anything. And they even took us on a little cruise in Hiroshima Bay and took us to the island where they had their naval training, and they showed us some of these small submarines, that one or two men submarines that they would go out and bomb places. And then we met close to where we lived Mr. and Mrs. Matsuoka, and he had been a houseboy for American soldiers, and so he knew kind of some English, and he liked ham radio. And there at the Iwakuni was a Marine base. They would put on a big air show there once a year. They would pick us up and we'd go there, and he liked that. And while we were there, we ate lunch one time, Thanksgiving, and they had all the Thanksgiving, the troops over there, Iwakuni, had all the missionaries from Hiroshima Prefecture and the next South Prefecture came together, and then we'd introduce ourselves. And I didn't know if anybody knew where Dinuba was, but I said, we're from Fresno. And then one guy got up and says, well, he was from Dinuba, one of the airmen there. And I said, well, I really am too. And they gave us this dinner. And later on, they would have a church service there. And so I went there one time, and I gave a message there for them, and they sometimes brought a person to Hiroshima for a church service. We had some missionary groups there, too, that got together. And, you know, you never know who you're going to meet and who they are.
What would you say you came to appreciate the most about the Japanese people or Japanese culture?
I think, actually, their language is hard, but it's a beautiful language. It has words that, like, when you say it's raining, but if it's a real hard rain, you say za-za for rain that comes very hard. And the people are very polite. We ate in a department store one time, and the waitress spilled a little something on my clothes, and they came and they apologized, and not only the girl, but the head people. And then they gave us some money for another meal and also money to have our clothes cleaned. I would like to go back again just to visit. We've gotten letters from people. One is Mr. and Mrs. Suzuki in the our second church, the Nosegawa Church. They lived in a little apartment when Gene and I went there for a Bible study once. And they had little kids running around. And after the Bible study, they started coming to church. And then he says, you know, he says, we have ancestor worship in our house, what they call a butsudan. It's maybe was 5 feet high, and a picture of the father and they offer prayers to him. And he says, I don't think that's right. And he says, I'd like to burn it up. And he brought it out to our campgrounds and we burned it up. And I think that was an honor to the Lord, because that family turned out to be four generations of Christians today and such wonderful workers in the church. I get a letter from them every year. And then from the Hiroshima church, I had a Mrs. Nakai sent us a letter. She could write a little bit English and everything's going well. And Mrs. Chikashige, she was a first Christian in Hiroshima Church. Her husband became a Christian, but he was a head of a Mitsubishi engineering company, and he passed away. He had a big sickness, and our church was very small at that time, so we used a neighboring church for the funeral service, and that whole auditorium was almost all men in black suits attending that service. I gave a message for that, and I don't know how many came to the Lord, but in a way it was a message of that I could honor this man that died and what his faith was and so on. Later on, we were going to have a Billy Graham crusade in Hiroshima, but his brother-in-law, Leighton Ford, was going to be the speaker. And this Tanimoto, we were wondering, I was on what they call the forward committee that comes out, and we decided that the best place to have it would be right there at his church. They had a big grounds, and we made it into like a small coliseum, and this Tanimoto could interpret. He knew English quite well, and he interpreted for him. The choirs, my wife had a choir in our church, and the other churches had choirs, and they came together and had a great, I think, 3 days of services there. I've often wondered, maybe that was the first crusade that they had in Hiroshima. I don't know.
I'm wondering if you have any advice or suggestions. Maybe there's some people out there listening who've thought about doing something like what you did, missions work, whether that's short-term or long-term, whatever. You have any advice for people who are contemplating that? Because it seems like a pretty big commitment.
Yeah, I have it written in there. Only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. Ephesians 1:21. I hope to continue this legacy so that someday I can say the same. I have no regrets. I lived for Christ.
You know, that may answer the question that I was about to ask you. I try to ask every veteran I interview this, and you get different answers from different people. But I'm always curious, especially when you've lived as long as you have, because 92 years is a long time. What would you say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I'm thankful for my life with my wife, over 71 years. I'm thankful for Terry and Sandy, both Christians, and they have children that are Christians and grandchildren that are Christians. And we have one great-granddaughter that is now baptized. And my prayer always is every night that as the other great-grandchildren grow up and can give their confession of Jesus Christ as their Savior, they too will be baptized. And so I guess mainly it's God, family, and the worship that we can do. Finally, when all is said and done, only what you do for Christ will last. Yeah, that's true, I think.
Well, and I'm sure you had a similar mindset when you were in the Army. A couple years active, then more time in the reserves. And because of your Army service, you were part of something a few years ago called Central Valley Honor Flight, where you got to go to Washington, D.C. and see a lot of things, including the memorial that's been built there for veterans of the Korean War, like yourself. What was that experience like for you?
I still think of it all the time, and that was a great experience. I went as a veteran. My son-in-law, Ed Green, was the guardian. We went on this trip, and we had a man that said, every time we would eat, before we'd eat, he says, and now we're going to pray, and I want all of you to say amen at the end. And it didn't matter on the plane or in the hotels where we ate. He did the same thing. That was a great trip. I enjoyed it so much. We landed at Baltimore, Washington there, and then we had three buses. They were all different numbers. When we pulled out onto the main highway, the highway patrol would stop all the traffic so the buses could go right on through. We thought that was pretty great. You know, they, in a way, it was an honor to us. And I have my picture over there of all the veterans. Yeah, that was a wonderful trip.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned the police escort, and I've had a lot of veterans tell me that that's their very favorite part of the trip. I'm thinking it's going to be the World War II Memorial, the Korean Memorial, the Vietnam Memorial, but there's something about feeling important if everybody else has to stop for you, I guess.
Well, I appreciate those memorials. I have been at the United Nations Memorial at Busan, Korea. I've been at the Punch Bowl in Hawaii. And I've been here in Washington, D.C. at the Korean War Veterans Memorial, but the bigger place.
Arlington National Cemetery?
Arlington National Cemetery. And the Korean Memorial, that was the first time I saw that. It is so realistic, you know, of the uniforms and what the people were wearing. And I still have my Army uniform here in the closet. It's when they use this Eisenhower jacket. I like to watch Jeopardy, and they asked one time a question about what was the uniform, the jacket during the Korean War. And I don't know if anybody got it or not, but it was the Eisenhower jacket, yeah.
I'm glad you said that, because that makes me think of one other thing I forgot to ask you. I'm sure Jeopardy is the favorite show of a lot of people listening right now. But they might have once appreciated a show called MASH, and you kind of lived MASH in Korea. Were there things about that program that really were pretty accurate or that brought up specific memories for you?
Oh, yeah. I think all the time. Some of the same characters, like that Klinger. We had Louis Kassar. He was from the island of Malta. And, yeah, we lived in tents like they did then. You know, that MASH program lasted more years than the Korean War. Once in a while, I still see it. I don't know, it doesn't come on very often anymore, but I always like to watch it.
And I know he's not alone in that. Something else Ivan has watched a time or two is a documentary film capturing the incredible ordeal that his son Terry survived in Indonesia while flying with Mission Aviation Fellowship. Terry grew up as a missionary kid in Japan and spent a decade on the mission field himself in Borneo. And as you might imagine, he has some powerful perspective on his dad.
First of all, my dad's a farmer at heart. And coming from a farming community, he loves being out on his farm. He has oranges. And he likes to plant and see the harvest. But he's a man of God and a man of integrity. And when you go out on the mission field and you leave everything behind, you find out how much you really need to depend on the Lord. We have so much to depend upon when we're just in our comfort zone. But to go out of your comfort zone, whether going to Korea or whether to Japan or wherever it might be, I ended up going to Indonesia. I found that I needed to depend on the Lord, and that's what he did, my mom and my dad. And he saw a great harvest there too. and it's continuing. And that's what makes, I think, his life very special, because he continues to see the fruit of his labor. But I love him. It's not always as easy as he might have said that, oh, things went good. No, there were hard times. And we all go through hard times. And we need to depend on the Lord to get us through those times. But yeah, I'm very proud of him and love him. And I'm glad I could listen to some of these stories.
As are we, of course. But I don't want to sign off without giving Ivan the final word. You're still getting around pretty well for 92. So what do you spend your time thinking about these days?
Our work in Japan still is on my mind. And every day I pray for the churches in Japan, not only our Mennonite brethren, but for all of the evangelical churches in Japan, that they will grow and that they will keep having Bible schools or seminaries and put out pastors and pastor wives, and that word will get out to not only the big cities, but also to the bigger villages. And I pray every day, too, for where Terry and Shelley were in Indonesia, for those churches to grow. And I wish my wife was here to be with us here, but she isn't. We have a little song that it goes, I change it a little bit. It says, Gene is in glory land that'll outshine the sun. And way beyond the blue. And she had a service out here at the cemetery. We haven't gotten a gravestone yet, but on there it'll be my name and then when I was born, and Jean's name when she was born and passed away. And then we have in parentheses Hebrews 12:2, just the first part, looking unto Jesus. And the whole verse is looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is now seated at the right hand of the Father. Terry's wife, Shelley, she plays a guitar, and she sang the song, Through It All. Andre Crouch, yeah. Through It All. I've learned to love God's word. I learned to depend on Jesus. That song means a lot to me. Finally, that's what all we can do here in this life, and best thing we can do, yeah.
Ivan Wolgamuth, 92 years young. You can find photos relating to Ivan and the stories he shared today at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That is all the time we have on the radio today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can join us again next time when we'll be reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.